Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
Today, we are traveling virtually to the sixth largest country in land area, and in its honor, we are flipping parts of the show. So if this surprises you that I'm doing the introduction, we're upside down because we are going down under. Since the beginning of the year, we have mainly covered privacy develops in the United States, the broader Americas, and in Europe. But the privacy community extends way beyond these two sides of the Atlantic coast. Surprise, surprise. What is actually going on in Australia and New Zealand? What does the privacy landscape look like in the Asia-Pacific region? And what are the main differences with the laws we become so accustomed to, like CCPA and GDPR? Our guest today is based in Sydney, Australia, and was one of the co-founders of the IAPP in Australia and New Zealand back in 2008. She worked for the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner, has held various roles in the private sector, and now leads her own consultancy. And I am delighted to be able to call her a friend. So my name is Kay Royal.
And I am Paul Breitbart, and welcome to Serious Privacy. And indeed, we have a special guest today. We also flipped our recording time, so for Kay it's late at night, and for me it's early in the morning, what we usually do the other way around. But we are delighted indeed to welcome Annelies Moens, a very Dutch name for somebody so far away. Annelies, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Paul and Kay. Absolutely delighted to join the podcast. And Paul, it's Belgian, not Dutch.
I'm well aware, but still, I mean, the sound is so Dutch to me.
I know. You pronounce it perfectly.
Well, so Annelies, before we dive into everything, it is now my role to ask the unexpected question. What is your favorite means of transport?
Well, I've been waiting in suspense for the unexpected question. My favorite means of transport is actually plane travel, and I can't do it at the moment.
You are as much restricted as all of us. Yes, I can imagine that.
Yes.
Kay, what about you?
I like fast cars. I like big, powerful horsepower engines, the older ones that really roar underneath you. So that is my favorite means of transportation. But if you asked me what would I prefer for transportation, I wish I had the ability to teleport because I hate flying.
Well, and why is that? Just the time it costs? Or
yeah, just sitting on a plane, just bored, twiddling your thumbs. I can't nap. I mean, it's horrible. I don't game, so it's horrible. It's just boring.
Well, I guess everybody expects that I would say that my favorite means of transport is a bike, being from the Netherlands, and I do like biking. But it's actually the train. The train for me is so relaxing, especially when going long distance on a train, just see the landscape pass by, do a bit of work, read a bit, watch out of the window, go for a walk to get some coffee. It's very relaxing, very soothing, and it's eco-friendly as well.
I did love taking the train from London to Paris. I thought that was awesome. The one time I've been to Europe, I did enjoy that.
Yeah, although the views for those 20 minutes are pretty bad when you are below the sea.
The Japanese trains are worthwhile trying as well. The Shinkansen, really fast trains. That's when you're really going into the future. That's the feeling.
They are still on my list. But as you mentioned, travel is a bit of a problem at the moment. Tell us, what are things like at the moment down under?
In terms of the health situation and the economy, is that what you're asking me, Paul?
Yes.
So We initially had a very good situation in terms of very few deaths, no major lockdowns required. But very recently in Victoria, we've had some outbreaks that have led to hundreds of individuals being diagnosed with COVID on a daily basis. So our second largest city, which is Melbourne, is now in lockdown. And that means that people are very restricted in terms of being able to go out. They have to wear their face masks everywhere. New South Wales, Sydney, where I live, it has the largest city in Australia. And we have around 10 per day at the moment. So we are very concretely trying to make sure that we don't turn into Melbourne. And so we have all of our interstate borders are closed. So not only not go overseas without a very good reason and approval from the government, we can't travel internally across our interstate borders.
That seems like a challenge, especially when doing business. Are you still able to work with all your customers? I guess also in Australia, everything has moved online.
Yes. Well, I was always working online and remotely globally anyway. So for me, my work hasn't changed at all, really, in that respect. It just means I just can't get on a plane to see customers overseas nor within Australia. But apart from that...
Well, I'll say, Annalise, that when people ask me about it, I've been working from home for years, but working from home when there are other people working from home in the same house has drastically changed my working environment. And working with people that now everybody else I'm working with is also working from home is changing the environment. It seems like everybody is sitting their butt in a chair for 10 hours a day almost. It's exhausting.
Yes, I think we are all working longer hours. I certainly feel that. And there's, you know, no more divide between work and personal life. It's just all completely meshed together. And I really like what I saw recently that you put out this question, Kay, are we living at work or working from home?
Right.
So I thought that was very apt.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm sure I wasn't the first person to come up with it, but I've now seen it since then turned into cartoons and things like that. So it's kind of crazy that, you know, we're living at work now. And I do feel the difference because now that everybody else is also running back-to-back meetings, I don't ever seem to get up from the chair. It's ridiculous. This quarantine 15 is definitely a thing. And if Paul keeps talking about all the food he cooks, then it's just going to be, you know, vicarious weight gain. But tell me, so let's move into more about you. Tell me how you got into privacy as a career. How did you start?
Well, 20 years ago, Kay, there was no such thing as a privacy career in the Asia Pacific.
And even 10 more, years ago, you know, there wasn't really one.
Exactly. So 20 years ago, I'd finished computer science, IT degree and a law degree. And, you know, I'd studied cool things like artificial intelligence and machine learning in the mid 90s, even in the US, so not just in Australia. And I was very clear about what I was not going to do. So I was not going to follow a traditional legal career path. So here I am looking for these alternative options, and I come across an advertisement from what was then called the Office of the Federal Privacy Commissioner, which was now known as the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner, and they had a huge number of roles being advertised. It was at the time where the Australian privacy legislation was being expanded to not only cover the federal public sector, but also the private sector. So they needed a huge intake of people to come and join the organization. So I joined as a complaints investigator and auditor. And on my first day, I remember being given 40 complaint cases and being told, Annalise, now you've got to resolve these. So I just jumped into the deep end and I ended up helping build that complaint handling and audit process.
That's how we all did it, right? We just jumped right in.
Yeah, absolutely. And so then I ended up compliance and took it from there. I did try to get out of privacy, though. So you can ask me about that one too, Kay.
You tried?
I did, unsuccessfully.
Yeah, I've said before, this is Hotel California. So what did you try?
So back when I was working at the regulator, I'd been there for about 5 years and it was starting to go through a long, lengthy law reform process, which led to amendments that actually came into effect in 2014. And I thought, this is going to take a long time. The decisions are going to be slow. you know, I'm going to see what else is out there other than privacy. So I took that as an opportunity to go over to Belgium, actually, of all places. And I did an MBA at Vlerick, which was a fantastic school. And then I took on roles as group manager, external relations manager. But I never really moved out of privacy because that was in around the time that the International Association of Privacy Professionals was setting up in Australia and New Zealand. So I was actually part of a group of directors, founding directors, who launched the IPP in Australia and New Zealand in 2008.
And I remember when that happened.
So I was on the initial board. Yeah, there you go. Okay. So I stayed on that board for the first 6 years and was its president as well between 2011 and 12. And so obviously now it's taken off. So I never got out of privacy, even though my day job later was out of privacy through the IPP, you know, during my spare time, that sort of kept me in there. And then from 2012, I started consulting in privacy. So now I'm running my own company called PrivCore. So I do a lot of privacy consulting for government and private sector organizations here and overseas.
And we love it.
Yes, maybe also to clarify, Annalise, you are one of our partners down under, right?
Absolutely, Paul. So it's really interesting how I came across TrustArc. So I'm the senior privacy consultant for the Asia Pac region as well for TrustArc. And so came across TrustArc when I was working on the APEC cross-border privacy rules system. So I was looking at, you know, what are the benefits of the system? Could Australia join? And I came across TrustArc through that work because TrustArc was one of the first accountability agents for the cross-border privacy rules system. So for those people who are listening who don't know what the cross-border privacy rules system, it's a framework that enables safe data flows between companies operating in the APEC regions because in APEC, there are diverse data protection and privacy laws. Some economies don't have privacy laws. So a mechanism was established to enable those safe data flows. So that's how I came across TrustArc. And TrustArc has been working in privacy for a very long time. And it's not an entity that has joined onto the privacy bandwagon recently. It's got that depth of expertise and it's got consultants that are operating globally. And so that complemented my privacy consulting business. And so that's why I'm also the senior privacy consultant for Asia Pac for TrustArc.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And we love it. And that's one of the things we all know that our podcasts aren't commercials, but you know, we're good and we know it.
Annalise, you already mentioned that the rules in Asia Pac are quite different and that some countries have legislation, some haven't. Legislation also between the countries is quite different. You have the boots on the ground. We right. don't. So what can you tell us about those laws? How different are they? Kay and I are very familiar with GDPR and with CCPA, and so are our listeners. But what about Asia Pac?
So, Paul, it's very difficult, firstly, to have boots on the ground in all places in the Asia Pacific because it is just huge. So let me give you a bit of context. So it's culturally and economically diverse. So when you look at, for example, the statistics from the World Bank and you look at all the major regional blocks in the world, you look at North America, it has about $22 trillion of GDP and about 364 million people. You look at the EU, it's got a GDP of around $19 trillion with a population of about 513 million. You look at Latin America, Caribbean, Middle East, and Africa, and you're looking at a GDP of around $11 trillion with a population of 2.1 billion. But then when you look at the Asia Pac region, South and East Asia and Pacific alone, so that's excluding the United States, you've got a GDP of around $30 trillion and a population of about 4.1 billion. So that just blows North America, the EU, Latin America, Caribbean, Middle East, and Africa out of the water from a population and GDP perspective.
Wow.
Absolutely.
I think we often forget that.
Yeah.
So, yes. So that's why I always find it fascinating when there's such strong discussions always about what's happening in the EU, what's happening in the US, the tensions between them. And then I think, hang on. What about the rest of the world? What about the Asia Pacific? So I think in the not too distant future.
You mean there's something else? other than the US and the EU in privacy?
Surprising, huh?
But no, but it is an area that a lot of people don't think about. And Australia and New Zealand, I think New Zealand's a little newer than Australia to it, but the Australian privacy rules and their privacy governance has been fantastic for years. It's just, I guess it wasn't as controversial, or maybe it wasn't as enforced, or the awareness of the enforcement wasn't as well known outside of Australia.
Well, that would be true for Australia because it's a population of about 26 million people, so it's a very small market. New Zealand's population is about 4 million. So again, a very small market. And so that's why if you're just looking at Australia and New Zealand on its own, population-wise, that's very insignificant. But when you're looking at the Asia Pacific region as a whole, then that's major. So earlier this year, I was going to speak at the Washington, D.C. IAP Summit until it got cancelled. And so as part of that exercise, I was doing some research on the Asia Pacific laws, and in particular, I was going to be on a panel looking at, you know, will GDPR effectively conquer the world? And, you know, what was my Asia Pacific perspective? And so, you know, I started digging into it, and I came across some interesting points, which I thought I'd share on our podcast today. So the first point that I wanted to make is that, you know, the question arises, are the Asia Pacific data protection and privacy laws based on GDPR? What do you think the answer might be?
No.
I guess they're not, because many of them are older.
That's right. So I had a look, and most of them are not based on GDPR. There is some alignment with the Philippines Data Privacy Act and GDPR, and also some of the provisions in the Indian Personal Data Protection Bill. But apart from that, none of the laws are based on GDPR. And it's still significant to be across them because most of them have extraterritorial application. So if you're a business outside of that region wanting to engage with the citizens, and might I add that's 4 billion citizens in the Asia-Pac region, you've got to be aware that those privacy data protection laws have extraterritorial application in most situations. There are two exceptions, and only one of them is going to be an exception for a very short time. It's Hong Kong doesn't have extraterritorial application, and nor does New Zealand until the 1st of December, when it has changes coming through on its Privacy Act, which I can talk about later. So those are two important points that came out of my research. And there's another thing that I think a lot of listeners might find unusual or not realize, that some of the key provisions in GDPR actually come from the APEC region.
That's interesting. Tell me more.
So the key concept that I'm thinking about is the concept of accountability, Paul. So our listeners are probably aware that GDPR has these provisions around accountability. And that's actually a concept that originally came out of APEC. So APEC had a privacy framework that was developed in 2004. And there are 21 economies in that APEC block. And so that concept was developed there. And there's a very good practical example and application of it in the Australian Privacy Act that I share, because I think it demonstrates it very, very well. So in the Australian Privacy Act, we have a cross-border disclosure provision, which essentially says, you know, Australian entities that are governed by the Privacy Act, you know, there's no problem in you transferring data offshore to another company or another country, as long as you are aware that if something happens overseas, so if that third-party company in that third country has a data breach or something else happens with the data, it's going to be treated as you, Australian entity, as having had that data breach. So that's a very strong accountability mechanism, so that it really lines up the incentives very well for Australian companies and governments to select entities or partners overseas that they trust, that they think will handle the data properly, because if they don't, it's the Australian entity that wears it. That's the default provision. There are exceptions if you don't want to be accountable, ironically enough. So if you don't want to be accountable, you need to, for example, get the consent of your customers and be very explicit about that. So there are exceptions, but that default accountability provision, I think, is a very good example.
Wonderful. And you mentioned something about changes coming. I've also seen some announcements from John Edwards, the privacy commissioner in New Zealand, about the new legislation. And I also believe that Australia is about to change some things. What can you tell us about that?
Absolutely, Paul. So there's big changes happening in Australia as a result of a digital platforms inquiry, and also in New Zealand, where changes to the Privacy Act have gone through and will become operational on the 1st of December. So perhaps I'll touch on Australia first, and then we can talk about New Zealand. Would that work?
Sure.
Okay. So in Australia, at the end of 2007, to provide a bit of background, the government asked our competition regulator, which we call the ACCC, to have a look at the impact of digital search engines on social media platforms on the state of media competition and advertising. And that was largely driven due to, in the background, a lot of the traditional publishing advertising revenue to social media and other and digital search engines. So and a lot of other issues. The report was reasonably broad, so they took a year to come up with a draft, which was published in December 2008, and then the final report came out in the middle of last year. And the government has provided two responses. It provided a response in response to the draft, and it provided a response in response to the final report. So what's interesting about this report is that a quarter of the recommendations relate to privacy. And they're not just limited to the digital search engines and social media platforms. So these recommendations, which have been essentially agreed by the government, will impact everybody who's regulated by the Australian Privacy Act. And that, of course, includes external entities that are dealing with this data through the extraterritorial provisions in the Privacy Act. So it has wide-reaching ramifications. There are a few points that I'd like to pull out that are going to be quite important, I think. The biggest change, penalties. So under the current regime, there are penalties of up to $2.1 million for breaches of the privacy legislation in Australia. But that's going to change because the ACCC wants to align those penalties with what is in the competition and consumer legislation. And so they want the penalties in the Privacy Act to align with those in the Competition and Consumer Act. And so what that means is that the penalties will change to $10 million or three times benefit received or 10% of annual turnover. I want to flesh out two points here specifically. Under GDPR, kind of penalty that relates to three times benefit received. So presumably, that could be quite a lot larger figure under the Australian regime because that's an unquantifiable amount. It depends on what the harm was or the benefit was effectively to that entity when they breached the privacy legislation. So because the penalty will be based on whatever is highest, okay? So it's either $10 million or three times benefit received, or if you can't work that out, then it's going to go on turnover.
Now, analyze. What does that mean, three times the benefit received? Because we're talking about breaches, or are we talking about misuse of data, which I know there's nuances there.
So I'm being very broad in my how I use the term breach. So I'm treating that as a very broad term. So it could be misuse. It could be disclosure. So I should really say it's an incident, right? So anything that is considered a breach of the Privacy Act in terms of whether it's security use, disclosure. So think of it broadly, okay? So
kind of like collecting biometric facial prints media or something and whatever you got from that. Okay.
Yes. Anything that could be considered a breach of the Privacy Act. So, or an interference with privacy is the language that they use. The other point around penalties, which I think is quite interesting, and I don't think there's been enough discussion about it, but it is something that I put in my submission to government when they were calling for submissions on the review to the Privacy Act, and it's around the 10% of turnover, because, you know, under GDPR, the turnover penalty has to do with worldwide turnover, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's interesting is that when the ACCC spoke about turnover, they didn't say whether it was domestic or worldwide. However, when the government talks about it, they talk about it as being domestic turnover. And so I think it's actually not entirely clear. And I think the reason for that is because if we use the same language, the same penalty language that is in the Competition and Consumer Act, place that in the Privacy Act, the wording has actually been tested in court under the Competition and Consumer Act because it's also silent around whether it's domestic or annual. Whether it's domestic or global turnover. There was a full federal court case, and in that particular case, when they're looking at the penalties under the relevant breach under the Consumer and Competition Act, the judges actually said, actually, it's not just limited to the turnover domestically, but also to your related entities that impact on your business. So I would argue that potentially, if you look at the judicial reasoning, that it could actually be worldwide. So I've actually asked that it be clarified, because even though the government says it's domestic, the ACCC is silent on it, and the judiciary has said, well, actually, it looks a lot more like worldwide. So I think it's an open question, and so it would be great to get some more clarity around that, because obviously that's quite significant.
And that would be really serious, 10% of your global turnover. I think it was in one of the initial proposals for the GDPR as well, but that never made it past the politicians because it was considered too much of a competitive disadvantage.
Yes. And of course, a lot of the Australian companies, if you just look at the Australian entity, they're small, right? But when you look at if that entity operates globally, then a lot of the revenue might be offshore, even if it relates to Australian users' information or Australian spending, right?
Absolutely.
A couple of questions come to mind for this one, and I'm going to try to make sure I don't forget both of them. So one of them is about the activity level of the enforcement in Australia. I don't see a lot of headlines about it, and it is something that I have looked in before, and I think a lot of people may be under the misunderstanding that Australia does not have an active enforcement agency, which it does, but I'd like you to speak more to that. But then also to the practicality. So although the GDPR allows 4% of worldwide turnover, it doesn't always happen. They take a very practical approach to, and I believe, Paul, you discussed this in one of our podcasts before, that they take a practical approach to, they don't want to put a business out of business. They want to be reasonable, but they have up to that amount to do.
Yes.
So first, the enforcement activity, if you can speak to that, about how active that might be. And then second, to the practical aspect that the enforcement might take.
Okay. So in terms of the enforcement, because I've actually got experience working at the regulator, obviously a long time ago, but this is still practice that's relevant today, is that a lot of the complaints are resolved by agreement between the parties. So the goal of the regulator, when there is a complaint and this complaint is substantiated and you know, it's determined that there is a breach of the Privacy Act, for example, then the parties agree most of the time to a resolution that works for both of them. So that happens like in about 98% of cases. And so That's why a lot of those decisions aren't being pushed out publicly, because they're being effectively resolved behind the scenes between the parties. But the problem with that, of course, is that the precedent doesn't get developed. And because I've been on the inside and I can see how it gets applied, most other people don't. And I think that's the detriment, is that we then get some court decisions that happen that seem very strange when you're so used to working in that area. And it's because there's not enough of that publication, not enough of that explanation or showing or demonstrating how the regulator interpreted the privacy law in relation to a specific set of facts. That's the first point I'd make. And the second point I'd make on that is that very recently, the OAIC has taken Facebook to court in relation to the Cambridge Analytica matter. So that's a live case. So that's going to take a fair bit of time to go through the court processes and the relevant hearings. So that's an active step they've taken, because they were investigating that matter for about 2 years before they decided to take the matter to court. So it'll be interesting to see where that lands, Kate.
That will be interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, with the regulator, they get so many cases, they're inundated. So there's like about a 1 year backlog. So if you were to put in a complaint today, it would take, in the normal course of business, if it wasn't expedited for whatever reason, it could take a year before it gets looked at. And so that is not necessarily great.
Yeah. That reminds me a lot of HIPAA in the United States, because it came in force back in, 1996 and been enhanced since then. But for the longest time, the regulators took the tactic of cooperating with any violations or complaints to work with them to improve the practices. The goal was to improve practices and help privacy get better. So a lot like what you're talking about Australia. But then, of course, they moved to more of a penalty. Well, there was always penalties, but a penalty-based system where their goal was to be more punitive than cooperative. And I don't want to cast any aspersions there, but they were running backlogs. You literally could have a complaint for a patient or something happen, and then you wouldn't hear about it for a year and a half, 2 years, and then boom, there'd be an investigation.
Yeah, that's right. So the question of resourcing is a live issue in terms of, getting that throughput of cases. I remember it was already an issue when I was there, and we were trying to work out really smart ways to try to, manage caseloads. And so we developed all sorts of techniques, but it's still taking a long time. And that's a resource issue more than anything else, I think.
And it's sad to hear that there's so many violations. I mean, why can't we learn not to do that?
It's like data breaches that happen every day.
Right?
At least, yeah.
I know. And it seems like it's only getting worse. And sometimes you think there's so many simple solutions, like, multi-factor authentication to reduce a lot of those, issues that, result in data breaches, that you think, just why aren't people just doing those simple steps and taking those simple steps?
Why aren't people using multi-factor authentication? It's like the simplest, most effective thing you can do.
Yes, exactly right. I agree.
Why aren't people using a password manager?
Yeah. Exactly.
Because they don't trust them. Because they have breaches.
Not all of them. So Annalise, let's move to New Zealand. There is big change coming up there, because it is one of the biggest reforms of their privacy legislation that's coming up, if I understand correctly.
Yes. So on the 1st December... Yeah, I mean, I haven't covered all the Australian points, but we can leave them just to the side. We'll just go straight to New Zealand. 1st of December is the important date for New Zealand. So that's when the amendments to the Privacy Act come into effect. So again, one of the main points is they will now have extraterritorial applications. So remember how I previously said that New Zealand was one of the few economies in the Asia Pac that didn't have extraterritorial application. Well, this amendment is going to change that.
Oh,
so that's
very
really,
nice.
Really important. Yes. And the other important thing is around mandatory data breach notification. So whilst we had that introduced into the Australian legislation before it was introduced into GDPR, New Zealand is now just introducing it on the 1st of December. It's also using tests around causing serious harm. If it's likely to cause serious harm, then you need to notify. But the penalty regime is nothing like what it will be in Australia. So, for example, if you have a breach that should have been reported or should be reported post 1 December and you don't, the biggest fine you could get is $10,000 New Zealand. So from a penalty perspective, pales into comparison to Australia. So that's the one aspect that's quite different. There are some changes happening to the way complaint handling may happen, I think, because it's interesting to note that of all the complaints that the New Zealand Privacy Commissioner receives, about half of them relate to access, so people not being able to get access to their personal information.
Wow.
So that's huge. And there's going to be a change to make that process a little bit different, because previously, it was very difficult if the Privacy Commissioner thought that the entity or the agency should have provided access. It was up to the individual then to enforce right to get access. The amendment flips that around. So in other words, where the Privacy Commissioner thinks that the personal information should have been provided to that individual, yet the agency, and they use the term agency quite broadly to mean government and private sector, if that agency things it shouldn't provide that personal information, then it's up to it to go to the Human Rights Review Tribunal to say, actually, we don't want to provide the personal information for whatever reason. So it changes the, the effort and the onus. And so it'll make it easier for that process to happen, I think once the Privacy Commissioner is of the view that, in that particular situation, access should be provided, it's not up to the individual to try to enforce and pursue their rights.
Oh, I like that. It takes almost a leaf out of the book of freedom of information, where the point of departure is that information is public unless in many of the FOI laws.
Yes, that's right.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. So that will affect their complaint handling, I think. It will make it much smoother, possibly, especially because that represents about 50% of their cases. The other interesting point is around enforceable compliance notices. So where the Commission is of the view that an agency is, you know, not doing something right under the Privacy Act or is in breach of a provision, they can write to them without a complaint having been lodged, or also with a complaint saying, you know, we think you're in breach of X, Y, Z. You need to take these steps to make these remedies, do these changes. And they can enforce that through the Human Rights Review Tribunal. So they've got a few more powers in that regard. So that's interesting. And they're also getting a new cross-border data flows provision, a new principle, number 12. So that's basically saying that New Zealand agencies can, you know, send information offshore if, you know, that the agency or the entity overseas has similar safeguards to the New Zealand Privacy Act or otherwise has to comply with New Zealand privacy law. Otherwise, if that's not the case, then they have to, for example, get consent from the individual. So that's a new principle that's coming into play as well.
So will New Zealand also introduce something like adequacy decisions?
No.
I know.
I was wondering the same thing because it sounded kind of like that's where you're going.
Well, no,
or they're going.
We actually, no, interesting, because we have something similar in the Australian privacy law as well, and it's in other Asia Pacific laws as well, you know. Where you send data to an entity in another country where you think they've got similar standards, it's okay. I hadn't really thought of it like from an adequacy perspective, because it's not formalized like that. It's not like there's a whitelist produced to say that, you know, companies operating in these parts of the world are okay to send your data to. The regulators never do that. They will never create a list, at least that I'm aware of, where they'll say these countries are okay. So it's different. So from that perspective, I think it's different to the kind of adequacy thinking in terms of, you know, actually saying a particular...
So y'all are just weird, Paul.
Well, I'm not sure it's very helpful to have these adequacy decisions. Of course, from a fundamental rights perspective, it is, but it complicates a lot of things at the moment.
Oh, does it now? Should we move into talking about adequacy decisions?
Well, maybe briefly. At least New Zealand has been on the adequacy list for a while. Australia hasn't. I assume, or at least that is my projection, that the changes in the New Zealand law are also partly inspired by the adequacy review coming up. What is the feeling about adequacy in Australia and New Zealand? Is it important to be adequate? Is Australia working towards getting adequacy as well? Does New Zealand really care about maintaining their adequacy status?
I'm not sure, Paul, if New Zealand was inspired necessarily to make changes because of the adequacy thing in the first place. But
Europeans still want to rule the world, right? I mean, that's what
but,
we are.
But I really can't speak on behalf of the New Zealanders, so I'll leave that. But it's an interesting point that Australia doesn't have an adequacy sort of pronouncement from the EU, so to speak. And that's primarily because its legislation doesn't apply to small businesses and political parties. So we have a small business exemption. So anyone that has an annual turnover of less than $3 million in Australia, unless they're a health service provider, and there are a few other small exceptions, they don't have to comply with the Privacy Act. So that's
Small business.
Below $3 million. Well, interestingly, most businesses, the percentage is enormous, are below $3 million. So actually, most of the private sector in Australia is not regulated.
Nice, because with all those restaurants, you have to spread the goods around.
Yes, and it's interesting now, especially in the current environment, because obviously the small businesses now, the restaurants, the venues, locations are all starting to collect personal information for contact tracing purposes, and most of them wouldn't have really thought about privacy before. So I'm not sure whether that's going to start pushing things in that direction in terms of regulating small business, but at the moment, there's that exemption. So that's a big difference. And that's why we don't have that.
That's really adequacy. Interesting. Are they going towards contact tracing? Is that something that's happening?
Well, the information is certainly being collected for contact tracing purposes. So if you go to a restaurant, you've got to leave your contact details and your name, and different entities and venues are doing that in privacy and secure ways, and some are not doing it in privacy and secure ways. So some of them are leaving the information on the counter for everybody else to see, which is not great practice, obviously.
Kind of like a sign-in list at a doctor's office,
yes,
huh?
Yes.
Now, are
totally.
The people of New Zealand objecting to this? Because I have to tell you, here in the U.S., you mentioned someone having to leave their name at a restaurant so they can do contact tracing, and everything just goes up in flames.
Well, it's happening both in Australia and New Zealand, and it's not going up in flames.
Isn't that crazy? We're the one without a federal privacy law, but oh no, we can't leave our name at a restaurant for contact tracing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that delves into the more philosophical areas around community versus individual rights, but we won't go there, Kay.
Yes, that might be a whole nother podcast, Annalise.
So yeah, we were on the adequacy for Australia, I think. You're not that Australia will ever get it because of the small business exemption, but do you see it brings any hurdles in doing business mainly with Europe?
Well, it's interesting because it's not such a, from what I see in the people I speak to and the privacy profession generally, it's not something that's talked about as a big deal necessarily, because we obviously still do business with Europe, and we have usually we're using standard contractual clauses of those kind of systems to have those data transfers in place. So what will actually be more interesting will be the impact of the SREMS 2 decision in light of any extra country risks that need to be considered where standard contractual clauses are in use.
Mm-hmm. What's the activity level around?
But every economy in the world is going to have to do its analysis around what are the... Mm-hmm.
Examining standard contractual clauses, processes for the businesses there.
That's only just starting because, don't forget, it's always predominantly been seen as an EU-US issue with the privacy shield, and it's only the standard contractual clauses has been a sort of a secondary issue that's come out of it. So only now sort of slowly being starting to be considered. But again, Australia is a small market. Asia Pac is not, but Australia itself is a small market.
Right.
On the global stage, intelligence laws in that particular right. economy, is there any disproportionate access to data by public authorities that will, I think, require an examination of some key laws in each economy around the world? And that may impact, you know, the standard contractual clauses, but obviously the European Data Protection Board still needs to determine, you know, what are the things that we're supposed to be looking at. But at the end of the day, obviously there's more questions than answers, but I think some of those issues around what intelligence laws are in place will need to be looked at for each economy.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, especially in the Asia Pacific region.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, everywhere really.
Vastly different approach in government. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, that's right. And like, for example, in Australia, we have mandatory data retention laws for metadata. So, and that was invalidated in certain places in Europe. So we have our metadata that is retained for 2 years. So,
wow.
And that can be accessed without a warrant by hundreds of organizations, really. So we have that in play. That's meant to be used for law enforcement and other purposes, but that gets accessed hundreds of thousands of times a year because it's done without warrant. So that's something that may have to be looked at. Mm. We've also got mm-hmm. our Assistance and Access Act. So there was a lot of discussion globally around this law, which was designed to have industry aid law enforcement to get access to, for example, encrypted communications when they're trying to investigate serious offences. So that is another piece of legislation that might need to be looked at in that context. And the other thing that I find interesting, of course, Paul, and you might have a comment on this, is that New Zealand, Australia, US, UK, Canada, of course, are all part of the Five Eyes Intelligence Sharing Agreement. And New Zealand has adequacy, of course. And so, you know, I don't know whether that will have any impact on all of these thinking, all of this thinking and the questions that need to be considered.
I think it will. And I also recently read that Japan might be joining the Five Eyes, becoming the Sixth Eye, because they are trying to counteract China much more. I'll link to an article in the Guardian from a few weeks ago in the show notes. But this is a concern. And I do believe that once the European Commission adequacy review report comes out in a couple of weeks, that especially the Five Eyes combination will also be addressed. If it is not, then that would be a serious oversight, especially given all that the court has said on national intelligence. And also because the Five Eyes will be of relevance for any UK adequacy assessment post-Brexit. So I think that we will hear more about this and what impact that may have on adequacy decisions and privacy cooperation data flows in the next couple of months.
Okay. So watch this space. Watch this space.
Absolutely.
I agree. And listeners who are not familiar with Five Eyes, absolutely go read the article that Paul is going to post in the resources, because it's fascinating. If you haven't looked at it before, and I know a lot of privacy people have not. I know I had not. So go read the article. It's really fascinating to learn about this and to see what actions they're taking. And I know that we're running out of time here, but I do have one last question, and I'm so sorry. We're gonna have a little bit long of a podcast this time, just a tad bit. But we're covering the world right now. When you look at US and Australia and Europe, we got a lot of miles between us. We deserve more time. And maybe this is just me not thinking right at late at night, if I haven't mentioned it's late at night. The adequacy decision for New Zealand, but does that have precedence over standard contractual clauses for EU data because you have adequacy? And so anything that you would forward transfer from your adequacy decision would be covered because of the adequacy decision in New Zealand.
Well, you wouldn't need the standard contractual clauses if you're relying on adequacy. It's another mechanism, right? So it's a choice, really. You can choose. That's how I see it.
Yeah, that's true. Once you have an adequacy decision, all the rest becomes more or less irrelevant, because then you have a means of transfer, and it is the highest standard. Although for onward transfers, you may still need to take a look at contractual legal basis, or indeed joining a CBPR mechanism in the Asia-Pac region or in other safeguards, because for onward transfers, then you also still will need to guarantee a similar level of protection as the adequacy
contract
was giving.
Yeah, interesting.
Partly because if the information is originating in Europe and you are a processor, for example, in one of the adequate countries, then you are also bound by the requirements of GDPR.
Right. True.
So then it's a double hat legislation that you will need to take a look at.
Interesting.
We like to make things complicated.
So there's lots of work for privacy people everywhere. Well, Annalise, I know we're coming to the end. Typically, this would be me asking this question, so maybe I should let Paul ask it. Was there anything else that we have not covered that you absolutely had a burning desire to make sure that you cover during our podcast?
There's so many things to cover, Kay. We've only scratched the surface. So, you know, I'm happy to be contacted by listeners later. But honestly, you can never stop talking about this.
We'll invite you back.
And we will post your information, how to get to PriveCorp with you as well. We'll make sure that we post all of your information and tag you with everything. But with that, then I will wrap up, since we are flipping things upside down. So if you like our series, please do tell your friends and colleagues about us. Should you have any questions or suggestions, please reach out to us via SiriusPrivacy@TrustArc.com. You can also comment on any LinkedIn posts, Twitter posts, send emails to me and Paul. We believe in the transparent part of privacy. You can find us. You can find Paul on Twitter as EuroPaulB, and myself as Heart of Privacy, and our podcast is on Twitter at Podcast Privacy. We're also on Instagram as Serious Privacy if you want to go check out Instagram. We have that too. So thank you for listening to Serious Privacy. Thank you, Annalise, for joining us. It's an absolute delight to connect with you. I miss seeing you since we didn't have the summit. I was looking forward to that. But until our next episode, goodbye.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey, listeners. Looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.